Well, welcome, everybody, to our continuing exploration of parting from the four attachments. So, last week we talked about how the Buddha's teachings can be divided into different categories or different types. And one type being mind training. Mind training started out oral teachings for about the first 1500 or 1600 years. And then when they arrived in Tibet, people started writing notes and jotting down teachings. And so now there's about 130 or 140 of these written down. The most famous ones are the 8-line, the 7-line, and parting from the four attachments. But Geshe Tashi Namgyo said, all of them can be summarized in one line. Would you like to know what the one line is? He said, the essence of all the mind trainings is that self-cherishing is the cause of all of our suffering and all of our problems. That's it right there. And that's the reason that Buddha Shakyamuni came and taught Dharma. So that's about as concise as it gets, I guess. But I also bring that up because we're going to talk about self-cherishing. We're going to reference back to that. So you can, that's the essence of the problem, our problems. And the thing about the mind training is that they're really pithy, they're really short, and so even one single word can have a meaning, or even more than one meaning. So last week we talked about when Drapa Gyaltsen, which is one of the texts that we're going to be using, he said, listen. And then we went into the three faults of the listener, the three cups, which is a famous teaching. But there's also another interpretation of that word listening, which is have the proper attitude when you listen. So the proper attitude, according to one teaching anyway, is that the Buddha is the doctor. We're sick with self-cherishing. Okay, we have this disease called self-cherishing. It's a habitual disease. Also contagious. The Buddha is the doctor. The Dharma is the medicine. The Sangha, meaning the exalted bodhisattvas, the very highly advanced bodhisattvas, are the nurses. Our practice is taking the medicine. When we do our practice, we actually take the medicine of the Dharma. It's not enough to have the medicine on the shelf and admiring the bottle, you have to take it. So that's what our practice is. It's taking the medicine. And the treatment plan, or the cure, is the enlightenment thought, which we're going to talk about some more later. And the result are the final cure is perfect enlightenment. So that's what's called the proper listening attitude. When we are told to listen, that's behind that word listening. And we talked about how Dharma can be taught in different ways. It can be taught by, according to Chogyam Trichen Rinpoche, great master, 20th century master, it can be taught by a great Dharma master from a throne. For example, when Lamdre is taught, it's always taught from the throne. Another way is you have the scholars, the great scriptural masters, who have memorized and studied philosophy and scripture, and they give very, very intellectual teachings, which a lot of us really, it's very difficult to understand. And then another way is what are called songs of experience. When a great master has an experience in their practice, then they spontaneously sing a song, and then somebody writes it down, one of their students usually. And some of these songs are quite famous. And the Drapa Gyaltsen commentary on Parting from the Four Attachments is one of those. It's a song of experience. So it's very sort of poetic. It's not intellectual in the sense that there's not a lot of scriptural references or anything like that. They're inspirational, too, to hear, to read. So we'll be using this text of his a lot, but we'll also be using some of the scholarly scriptural texts, too, to give you a flavor of those, and we'll be cross-referencing those. And there's many and many of those, but we'll be getting into those, too, eventually. So in Drapa Gyaltsen's text, he starts out with the homage to his gurus and the promise to write the text, or to say the text, which is a very traditional way of beginning text. And he very cleverly, in my opinion, sort of eases us into the first line. He doesn't announce the first line, you know, like a scholarly text might. He just kind of dances into it, and you don't even know you're into it, and you realize, oh, he's into it already. Which is, if you're attached to this life, you're not a true Dharma practitioner. That's the first line. So what he says is that if we really want to be free from attachment to this life, it's true we need the traditional format of hearing, contemplation, and meditation, but before that we need moral conduct. And so he puts moral conduct in the head of that list. What's normally a traditional list of three becomes four. He says it's really a requisite to have moral conduct, and he gives three reasons or three benefits that moral conduct produces. So it produces a higher rebirth in the future, is one of them. And it also produces the possibility of attaining complete enlightenment. But besides that, it's an antidote for all of our problems and miseries and suffering and dissatisfaction that we have in this life. It's also very practical for this life, too, to be moral. Your life goes better when you're moral. So he gives those three reasons. And he says that moral conduct is like the fertile soil that the other three, hearing, contemplation, and meditation, can grow in, grow out of. So that's an image that he used. It's a prerequisite or a requisite in the sense that it creates the environment for those other ones. And he says, conversely, that if you don't have moral conduct, you might as well abandon your hearing, contemplation, and meditation. Because actually what you are doing is you're creating a cause for a lower rebirth. Which is kind of sobering, if you think about it. So it's really important to pay attention to this moral conduct aspect of this presentation. Before you even think about doing the other three, you need to understand that. And so he goes into a little bit of detail about that. And there are two types of moral conduct, according to him. The first type he doesn't actually name, but I call it common morality. That's just the name, the title that I put to it. And then the second one is what he calls pseudo-morality, or false morality. So we're going to look at those two just to see what he's talking about here. So common morality is for anybody that wants to have a precious human rebirth, which we're also going to go into in some detail later, but if you want to be a spiritual practitioner, you need to have a rebirth that facilitates it, precious human rebirth being the best one. It's not possible to have that kind of rebirth unless you accumulate virtuous action or merit, positive spiritual energy, in this lifetime. Okay, because you're going to be thinking of the next lifetime. You got to create it now. And virtue is absolutely necessary if you want to have a positive rebirth. So what are virtuous deeds? We talked about this last week, that sometimes in Dharma teachings, it's presented as what you shouldn't do first, and then what you should do after. So this is one of those cases that virtuous deeds consist in refraining from non-virtuous deeds, specifically the 10 non-virtuous deeds. Now, that might seem counterintuitive, but one of the reasons for that is we are living in a degenerate age. Karma goes up, karma goes down, merit goes up, merit goes down, lifespan goes up, lifespan goes down. We're on the downslope. We're in the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age, and the evening news kind of verifies that. One of the ways to create virtuous deeds in this type of environment is to abstain from non-virtue, because it's easy to be negative. There's plenty of that going around. It's important to know what the non-virtuous actions are, and the classical list of 10 consists of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, which are the non-virtuous actions of body, lying, slander, harsh speech, and idle speech, which are the 4 non-virtues of speech, and envy, ill will, and holding wrong views, which are the 3 non-virtuous actions of mind. So that's what we could call common morality. Those are, you know, fairly obvious. It's not exclusive to Buddhism to not lie, steal, and kill. It's just about being a good person. But then Drapa Gyaltsen goes into the second kind of morality, what he calls pseudo-morality, or false morality. And this is where it gets interesting for practitioners. There's 2 types that he talks about. One is moral conduct, or this false conduct, that doesn't abandon the 8 worldly concerns. And we're going to talk a lot more about those. And then the second type is what he just calls false moral conduct. Examples of that would be a practitioner who has pride, or contempt, or competition, or jealousy. And we're going to talk about those too. So those are the 2 types of pseudo-morality that he warns about. Particularly the first one that we Dharma practitioners need to pay attention to, because as he said earlier, if we're doing our practice, our listening, our contemplation, and our meditation, and we don't have really pure moral conduct, you can actually create non-virtue doing that. And that's obviously not what we want. It's counterproductive. So this is something that, personally, I think is really important. And he mentions the 8 worldly concerns 3 times. So in a very short text, that's a lot. So it's worth going into, I believe. This is a list, the 8 worldly concerns, it's seen commonly in teachings. It's all over the place, but it isn't really explained that often. So I want to take a little bit of time tonight to go into it so that we understand what are the 8 worldly concerns, so that we can make sure that our practice is pure and we're not making this mistake that he warns about. Okay? going to be talking a little bit about how this teaching is translated. And I want to be clear that this is not a criticism of the translators. It's not. In fact, we have a great, we owe a debt of thanks to the translators and interpreters, starting with the Indian Tibetan teams that worked over the centuries bringing the Dharma from India to Tibet, but also today all the great translators that are now being trained and practicing and bringing the Dharma into, you know, Western languages. I just want to be clear, I'm not criticizing the translators, I'm actually honoring them, but I do want to clarify a little bit of what I think is some confusion about how this is presented. Geshe Thachi Namgyel actually said you should view your translator or your interpreter as your teacher too. So he personally considered the translators on the same level as he was as a teacher. To me, that makes sense, because if the translators and the interpreters weren't there, we wouldn't have a clue, really, about what's being taught. So thank you to all the translators and interpreters, and it's not an easy job. Having said that, I had a little bit of problem, this word concerned. I did a very quick Google of this, how these are translated, just very quickly, and I saw that it was translated, there were 9 examples of how that 8-worldly whatever was translated. There's all different ways it's translated. 8-worldly concerns is one of the common ways that you see it written. And for me personally, I don't know, concern, I'm concerned about the price of tea in Darjeeling because it's getting more expensive in the supermarket. I'm concerned about what the weather's going to be like tomorrow, whether I have to wear my raincoat or not. Concern is kind of wimpy in my opinion. And some of the other words, you know, the 8 worldly dharmas, which is confusing to a lot of us because dharma has a lot of different meanings and it has nothing to do with holy dharma. The 8 worldly, you know, these words that are used don't really give the true meaning of this topic. And so what I have come up with, this is me, is the 4 poisonous dichotomies, which gives a lot more oomph to what we're really getting at here. This is not a concern. This is darn poisonous. As you can see, they're divided into 4 pairs. And again, there's a lot of different ways these pairs are translated, but I just picked out what are very common translations of these words. So you have happiness and unhappiness. You have fame and infamy or bad reputation. You have praise, and you have blame, and you have gain and loss. And those are how they're very commonly listed. With some, you know, some variation, but that's a general idea of them. So if you look at those 2 lists, they're very different, aren't they?
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
I find it really nice that there's like opposites, but like in most, like in generations, like now, we don't really think about how the opposite, like you have to have one, the one doesn't exist without the other, and that's why that's there, right? Like, I mean, wouldn't you want to, okay, so anyways, maybe I'm... Just continue, sorry.
I'm not sure they're there because they're opposites, but maybe. Let's go through it some more, okay. And then maybe we can figure that out together.
Okay.
I'm not sure how to answer your question. If you look at these 2 lists, on this side you have happiness, fame, praise, gain. And over here you have unhappiness, infamy, blame, and loss. Now, our natural reaction is what?
To want one and not the other.
I like this list. I'm not so crazy about this list, right? That's our natural, and not only our reaction, but that's how we live our lives. And that's the problem. Dungse Asanga Rinpoche calls it believing the big white lie. And I think he's being generous when he calls it a white lie. I think it's a dirty poison. And we need to get this straight if we want to avoid this problem that Drapa Gyaltsen is talking about, which is this kind of false morality where we think we've got it, but we really don't. I want to do a little exercise with you, if you're willing, to bring this out of the words and intellect and down into the feeling level a little bit. So to just pick one, let's pick acknowledged or acknowledgement. So just think of a time when you were acknowledged in your life. Maybe it was your boss, maybe it was your parents, maybe it was your teacher, maybe, I don't know, somebody acknowledged you for something you did or something you said or someone you are. It was an acknowledgement that you got. And just, if you can remember an instant of that specifically, how did that feel? How did you feel when you got acknowledged?
Happy. I felt sad.
You felt sad?
Yes.
Why?
Well, if I could elaborate for a moment, the person who was speaking recognized me as the moral compass of the department. And I felt really sad if that were truly the case. It couldn't possibly be the case.
I get that. I understand.
Okay, was it the acknowledgement that made you sad or the fact that that was the situation?
Both.
Okay. Okay.
It sort of showed the state of the situation there, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So I get that.
Anybody else have, what do you feel, what did you feel or do you feel remembering being acknowledged?
I guess proud of my actions, or like proud, yeah. Happy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now, on the other side, have you ever been falsely accused?
Yes.
So just remember that and how that felt.
Angry.
Sad.
Frightened.
Yeah. Okay, let's do some more and see what comes up, okay? Did you ever feel passionate about something?
Yes.
So just take a moment and feel, what was that like? I really feel passionate about whatever.
Energizing.
Uh-huh.
That's the word I was thinking.
Yeah. Okay.
Validated.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Righteous.
And how about if you were not interested or bored? Have you ever been bored or not interested in something? Is that energizing?
No, tiring.
What's another good one we could pick? How about winning? Have you ever felt, I'm a winner, I won that, or I'm on the winning side or the winning team, or I'm a winner, or we won, or...
Never felt that.
Never? You're on the wrong team. Do you ever play a sport and win? Or a card game, or a board game?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we won. Or how about losing or being defeated? Also in life. Ever felt respected?
Mm-hmm.
Ever felt lack of respect? Disrespect?
Mm-hmm.
We could go on through the whole list, right? But you get what I'm saying is on this side, generally, there's a certain kind of feeling or energy that you get. And on this side, it's very different.
That side's grasping and that side's aversion.
Exactly. And hold that thought because we're going to talk about it. But would you agree that this list is very different than this list generally?
Indeed.
In terms of how we relate to it and how it affects us? Yeah. This is yes, this is no. Well, the problem is, it's all a big white lie. But we believe it, and we live it. And as a result, we end up with self-cherishing, which we just heard was the cause of all of our problems. They aren't really concerns, they are poison.
Would obsessions be another word?
A what?
The eight worldly obsessions?
Yeah. There's. I didn't write down the nine lists that I Googled, but yeah, I think that was on it, actually.
Well, they also are enormous obstacles.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In this way, it's a huge obstacle.
Yeah.
You could say preoccupations.
And, sorry?
Yeah.
You could say preoccupations.
That's another one, yeah. Yeah. And even pleasure and pain. I mean, we always say things like, oh, everybody wants to be happy. I mean, you hear that all the time, right?
Yeah.
And nobody wants pain. I mean, if you're not mentally, you know.
Kinky.
But generally, you know, we like pleasure and we don't like pain and suffering. Mental, physical, emotional, whatever. And what do? Is we grasp on this side and we have aversion on this side, right? And we do this without really consciously thinking about it. Usually,
mm-hmm.
We just kind of run on automatic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to think about, do I like happiness? Do I not like pain? You don't go around thinking about that. It's just the way we are, the way we run. But it's a habit. All of these are habits. And they are problematic habits that are not really examined, usually. Even in Dharma teachings, the eight worldly concerns are just usually kind of just thrown out there as if we're supposed to know what they are and how they work, usually. It's important to start to understand that this is the big white lie that we need to start seeing through. Otherwise, we're going to end up down here promoting our self-cherishing and creating this cyclic existence thing that we're caught up in, around and around and around. So, Lorna, you said, what did you say? This was what?
That list is grasping.
Grasping, and this one is?
Aversion.
Aversion, okay. Those of you that did the last course, does that ring a bell? Those two ring a bell at all? Of the many lists that we studied?
Pretty central.
Huh?
It's pretty central.
Yeah. So those are two of?
Three poisons.
The three poisons, are they not?
Yeah.
Are they not two of the three poisons? Anybody remember the third one?
Disinterest.
Okay. Okay, synonyms, disinterest, ignorance, delusion, indifference, right? That's the third. These all have synonyms, right? So that's the third one, the three poisons. I didn't write it in here, did I?
Yes, you did.
Huh?
Poisonous.
Four poisonous dichotomies.
No, but I'm talking about the three poisons from
the
previous course that are generally listed, the three poisons, which cause all the other poisons, which cause all of our problems. The primary poison being ignorance or delusion.
But you could encapsulate all of that in those.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the point. So what this really is a kind of white lie about the three poisons that we're drinking the poison, folks. Without even knowing it. And what do we do when we realize we drink the poison, Laurel? Remember?
Oh.
What do you do when you realize, oh, I drank poison?
Oh, you panic.
Oh, you panic and you have regret. You go,
oh, yeah.
I'm sorry I did that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So if you're taking notes, or at least in your mind, you want to see these as the children, the descendants of the three poisons.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, bad news.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We don't normally think and act that way, though. We think happiness and pleasure and fame and winning and money and gain and all that stuff are good. Most of us. The Dharma actually has given us a hint about pleasure, that it's not necessarily a good thing, because when we study the four mistaken conceptions that we have that keep us going around and around samsara, cyclic existence, pleasure is number one. So in other words, we think we're having pleasure when we're really having suffering. And again, going back to the Three Visions course, we talked about three different kinds of suffering, right? Remember that? Suffering of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Suffering of change.
Suffering of change.
Conditioned existence.
Conditioned existence. Okay. So we mistake, in one of those categories, or one of those situations, we mistake suffering and we call it pleasure.
Well, we think pleasure is making us happy. When we experience pleasure, we think it's making us happy. Right?
That's what we think. That's what we think.
How can we prove that?
Prove what?
Like that when we are experiencing pleasure, we're actually suffering.
Listening, contemplation, meditation.
Okay.
If you analyze and look into your experience, you will see that's true. And that's exactly what you have to do, because that's what the Buddha said to do. He said, don't take my word for it. Try it out in your life. That's how you do it. This is all intellectualization here. This is all listening.
Mm-hmm.
You need to think about this, and then you need to meditate on it. And then it goes in, and then you see the truth. Or not. Maybe this is all nonsense.
Yeah, if you just take one point, which Michael just touched on, and that's change. Right? All things change. It is, in fact, the constant mm-hmm. in our experience.
Incurement.
So that's nothing but impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're really happy,
except
you want to grasp on to that, but yes, you want to grasp on to it and hold on to it. It's impossible. Therefore, built into it is suffering.
Okay.
Your grasping at it makes you suffer.
Exactly.
Like I'm afraid of losing what I have. That's your suffering.
Okay.
That's a form of suffering.
That makes sense.
So, just to finish the list of the misconceptions that we operate under, we think ourselves is real. We're going to go into that later. It's not. We think our body is clean. It's not. And we think impermanent things are permanent, like things, relationships, family, people. We operate, even though we give lip service and say, no, of course it's impermanent, of course I'm going to die, we give lip service to it. But if you look at how we lead our lives, we mostly have mistaken conceptions. Now, another thing to maybe think about in all of this is we tend to hope for these things and we tend to fear these things. Now, when we say hope, I'm not talking about optimism. I mean, I'm optimistic I'm going to become enlightened one day. That's not the kind of hope I'm talking about. It's more like
desire.
Wishful thinking. It's more like, gee, I really hope I win the lottery with that ticket I bought. It's wishy-washy hope. We kind of hope that we will be happy. We kind of hope that we'll be prosperous and be praised. And we, again, it doesn't have to be conscious. This is all operating at a very subtle level in our minds. We're just kind of running on automatic from beginning this time, lifetimes of habit. And so we're actually a prisoner of hope. And I'm going to read you some quotations afterwards from great teachers so that you don't think I'm just making all this up. Well, we also operate out of fear. And again, we might not acknowledge it or we might not be in contact with it, but we do have fear. We have fear of pain. We have fear of suffering. Some of us have fear of death and so on, or being falsely accused or whatever. It depends on your experience in life and your propensities and your karmic predicament, as Ram Dass used to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just wrote some synonyms and some similar words here, but you can put in all kinds of words here, and I invite you to do that for your own particular life and your experience and what triggers you. Some people don't care about their reputation, obviously. Other people are very sensitive about it. So this is where we get into the contemplation part of the listening, contemplation, meditation, to think about it and to make it real for you, how it applies to you. And the benefit is that it purifies your practice. It gets you out of this kind of pseudo-morality that Drapa Galtzen mentions three times in the text. So that's the white lie that we're operating under. Have I left out anything? So the white lie is that the three poisons are masquerading as happiness and pleasure and so on, and fame and praise and gain. Okay, so that's an in-depth look into Drapa Galtzen's song the only phrase he says is eight worldly concerns. But that's what's underneath it. So now I'll read you some commentary that some teachers have said about these topics. One teacher is Dzongtsar Kenzi Rinpoche, which maybe some of you have heard of. He's a contemporary teacher. Somewhat provocative sometimes, but always stimulating, I think. He says that morality that stems from attachment to worldly life and performed for the sake of gain, fame, respect, recognition, publicity, all this so-called morality is contrary to correct or true morality, which is exactly what Drapa Galtzen says. And he goes on to say, one benefit of bringing all this to mind again and again is that our attitude towards life changes. What used to be a big deal is not a big deal anymore. What used to work us up no longer gets us worked up. Whatever used to drive us crazy, such as fame, shame, praise, blame, loss, gain, pleasure, and pain, quit driving us crazy. Slowly, slowly, we become indifferent to the eight worldly concerns. Whether we lose or win makes no difference to us at this stage. The eight worldly concerns cease to matter to us. We become seasoned Dharma practitioners with good life management skills. I love that phrase. Right. I have good life management skills. Our general outlook is everything's fine, whatever the outcome, however things work out. And therefore, we're not driven by worry. And therefore we are happy. And then people start to notice that. When we are easygoing and friendly, because we have no agenda and no triggers that make us crazy, then we're a very likable person to be with. And then whatever we say may have a big impact on people. And then we are beginning to become quite an effective bodhisattva. We become free because we cannot be bought by the eight worldly concerns. So, we should pray someday that we go beyond the eight worldly concerns, truly not caring whether we are being praised or criticized. From the mundane worldly point of view, whenever you are praised, you're supposed to be happy. And when you're criticized, you're supposed to be unhappy. However, the sublime beings are not moved. This is what you have to aim for. So, continue in a way that any decent human being would want you to behave, but at the same time, let this alarm continuously sound in your head. All of this is useless. The supreme sign of great practitioners is not that they sprout a halo or they have extraordinary auspicious dreams or that they experience bliss continuously or that they can foresee our miserable futures. The supreme sign is that they no longer have any interest in material gain, fame, respect from others, or being the center of attention. The purpose of Dharma is not to make us happy. The purpose of Dharma goes beyond happy and unhappy. The purpose of Dharma is to achieve enlightenment. And this point is emphasized by Manjushri, Sachin Kunga Ningpo, and Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen. As a Buddhist practitioner, even though you know only too well that death is imminent and inescapable, it is very likely that your calendar will always be full of business meetings and social events, and whatever your beliefs, there will always be a summer holiday to plan, or a family Christmas, or Thanksgiving dinner, or a birthday party. But, as I have already mentioned, there is no guarantee that any of your plans will actually come to fruition. So hanging on to the belief that everything will work out for the best only stokes the fires of disappointment. Remember this, because it's an important point. Most of humanity's most serious problems arise from blind hope and unreasonable assumptions. As death draws near, try to give up your worldly concerns. Stop worrying about your family. Stop making plans. Stop thinking about what you haven't managed to accomplish and all of the appointments in your calendar. I think he should have said, and have a nice day after that, but he didn't.
But isn't that planning? To have a nice day.
So, to summarize the eight worldly concerns, all of the eight worldly concerns arise from the poison of self-cherishing. The eight worldly concerns are like armor which protect the beast of the self-cherishing ego. The stronger our self-cherishing is, the more they strike us. And we can become a victim to one of them or to all of them. And they can even come to dominate our lives. For example, we are elated when we are praised, and we are depressed when we are criticized, insulted, or belittled. We are happy at success, and depressed or sad at failure. We have a joy acquiring wealth, and we are dispirited when we become poor. We are pleased at fame and depressed or even angry at lack of recognition. True Dharma practitioners should ensure the cultivation of altruism and not be defiled by the four poisonous dichotomies. The conclusion is that morality should not be kept with any intention based on attachment to this life. For example, your good name, your fame, your status, your worldly possessions, and so on. Because the result of that will only be the cause for accumulating the eight worldly concerns, which are types of attachment to this life. And that's what Drapa Gelson warns us about in the first line of the four attachments. His Eminence Chogye Trichen Rinpoche said, If one uses one's adherence to moral conduct as a means for attracting respect or honor or a good reputation or personal happiness in the present lifetime, all we are really demonstrating is how trapped we are in samsaric attachment. And he gives the example that you can practice generosity, one of the six perfections, you can practice it, and the karmic result of that is wealth. Okay? But if you don't have the proper motivation when you do that, it doesn't even produce a human rebirth. And in fact, you could be reborn as a poodle with a diamond collar in a rich family. So you need to really have your motivation lined up. It's not just enough to practice generosity. And also the same is true for all the other perfections. Without moral conduct and without separating ourselves from attachment to this life, the other perfections do not even guarantee a higher rebirth. So this is one of the things that practitioners, we have to be aware of. You can't just think, oh, I'm doing the perfections, I'm practicing. But if you don't have this pure motivation and clarity of the delusionary poisons and downfalls, not only do you not guarantee a higher rebirth, but you could actually create a lower rebirth. So that's not something to take lightly.
Michael?
Yeah.
I guess only experienced Buddhists would be concerned about rebirths, right? Because, like, personally, I don't care. Like, I'm not into the rebirth aspect of things. I'm into, like, what can I do now in this lifetime to fix myself? If I become a dog next rebirth, so what? I'll live a dog, right? Like, I'm not... It seems so... I can't conceptualize a next rebirth. I can't even conceptualize my past rebirths. Like, that to me is, it means not, like, that's nothing. Like, it's like, what are we talking about? But I guess for Buddhists, it's a big deal. And it seems like a lot of it is centralized on that. Because to them, it's very real. To me, it's not.
Do you believe in rebirth?
I do. But again, okay. I'm not concerned about...
Yeah, I hear that. Okay. Do you believe in karma?
Habit. I think about karma as like habit,
Karma, it means action. It means if I do this action, I get this result. What goes around comes around.
Okay.
Do you believe in that?
I do believe that my actions have consequences. Yes, I do believe in that.
Okay. Well, I like dogs, most of them. But it's certainly not, from a spiritual point of view, it's not a precious human rebirth, and
right.
You will not go forward spiritually,
right.
And you will not create any merit. So if you burn up your positive merit, and then you go and become a dog, and you don't have any more positive merit, you definitely won't go up, and you'll probably go down. So it's a downward path, if we don't think about the next life. Geshe Tashi Namgyo said, the next life is more important, and the next life is more dangerous. And the reason it's more dangerous is if you don't have rebirth where you can practice in, you burn up your merit, it's dangerous, you have a great danger of going down.
Well, we also think that a dog is happy and has a lovely life if they're treated well. But actually, in a dog's mind, they live in constant fear all the time, and they're always bouncing between grasping and aversion all the time in the extremes of it. It's a karmic expression of in their mind. So you may not think, I don't care if I'm a dog, but dogs really suffer.
I'm suffering right now. What's the difference?
But in this, but as a human, you can do something about that suffering.
And that's
but
what
as
I'm
a dog,
interested.
You can't. And that's the difference.
And that's fair. And I'm more interested in, like, what can I do now rather than, like, my rebirth? Like, it doesn't... If I fail at what I'm supposed to do now, then the consequences of my rebirth will just come naturally. I don't see the point in, like, fixating on my rebirth. It's, like, to me, that's just...
It's not a fixation, but it's an outcome of how we live our lives now. That's all. But it's not a fixation.
Okay. Fair enough.
But it is... The next rebirth is an outcome of how we live this life and how we've lived our previous lives.
Right.
So it's all an outcome, which is the whole action and consequence.
Yeah.
So it's understanding that in sort of a bigger context.
Okay.
Sometimes, too, I look at it like, for example, we brush our teeth or, like, shower every day so we don't have all these problems, right, in our lives. There's certain maintenance things we do every day to function well. And I almost look at it like that sometimes. Like, that can be helpful to, like, remind me. It's like, oh, yeah, I do kind of do things for the future a little bit, even if I don't think of it.
Right, and that's, I think, like, where I'm coming from. It's, like, I feel like if we take care of ourselves right now, I don't have to consider the future. Like, who cares? Like, I should be focused in right now. That's how I feel. Because it feels like, I can't grasp that. It feels pointless, because I have no control about what I'm going to be, like, it just makes no sense. I'm right here. I don't know. That's just
me. If Dharma practice helps now, it'll help in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Even if I'm whatever I rebirth in.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know. It sounds
but
like
I,
a good motivation in a way. If you're like, it's working.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
I don't know.
We're going to go into precious human rebirth some more. But just to kind of wrap up your comment, when we have a precious human rebirth, we have control. We have control over this life, and we have control over future lives. And that's unique. Dogs don't have that. Worms don't have that. Hungry ghosts don't have that. Hell beings don't have that. No other realm has that. That's why it's called precious human rebirth. So by living a moral life, this life, we have a better life. But we also, as he said, we also create the conditions for a better life next life. If you just say, oh, well, it doesn't matter, that's really risky. That's really, really risky. And we've been going around and around and around and around and around since the beginning of this time because we didn't get this. We didn't get it. We have a chance now. We have an opportunity now to get it and to do something about it and to have our hands on the steering wheel instead of driving with no hands on our wheel, steering wheel. That's what precious human rebirth is about, is taking advantage of this incredible opportunity that's really, really rare. That's the thinking behind it anyway.
Mm.
Yeah.
Food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate your questions, though. They're provocative. So I just want to read one more quote, and then maybe we'll do a little bit of meditation about this. This is Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche again, but not quoting about the eight worldly concerns, but quoting about impure morality, or false morality. He says, "For many years I was a critic of lamas who sought high thrones and high titles. That is, until I had the humbling experience a few years ago, when it suddenly struck me that these lamas who, with my very, very limited perception, I saw as competing for the highest throne and the highest title, were actually much less hypocritical than me. And why? Because they didn't even pretend to be humble, which was actually much more honest than I with my false modesty. And the inside glimpse of this was so embarrassing for me, to say the least." And that's what I think really, at least for me anyway, is what I've done with these, is to really take a deep look you know, where am I in this chart? What triggers me? What doesn't? What am I attached to? And so on. And it's really transformative when you do that. And then he went on to say, it's easy to say we have the right motivation, but we have to check carefully to make sure that this is indeed the case. Are we here to listen to these teachings with the goal of reaching enlightenment? Well, we all like to answer yes to that question, don't we? But we should ask ourselves, do we honestly wish to achieve enlightenment? You should seriously contemplate this. And then he says, actually, for me, the idea of enlightenment's not that attractive. Samsaric success and gain and influence and the games we play are more attractive. I'm very much in favor of samsara and in favor of enlightenment as a romantic ideal with a golden hue, radiant and omniscient, and all of that is fine. But only in times of distress, when I'm flying in an airplane and it encounters turbulence, do I ever really think about enlightenment. And then as soon as I'm safely back on the ground and surrounded by my friends or family, then the desire for attention and gain holds sway over me. And I don't give enlightenment a second thought. So let's remember to tune our motivation every now and then, especially at the beginning of each session. Okay. So that's the listening and somewhat of the contemplation part of this. So let's take a few minutes to do some meditation about this. So take a minute to find a comfortable posture. And if you want to, you can take two or three breaths just to kind of transition from all of these words into a meditative state. So today has been a very auspicious day because I had the chance to taste ancient wisdom that's more than 1,000 years old, that has come down to us in a real lineage through authentic masters. I've had the opportunity to look at something that I never really thought much about before, or at least look at it in a different way. And I'll probably think about this some more, but for now, I just want to let it sink in and remember that self-cherishing is the problem. It's the cause of the problems that I have, the suffering that I have. It's a kind of poison. And it spreads. Spreads in ways that are not evident into the eight worldly concerns. Half of which I'm not even concerned about most of the time. And as a result, I've circled again and again in cyclic existence, never being truly free. just out of habit, strong habit. And most of the people around me have the same habit, and so it seems normal. But the wisdom beings see the folly of all of it, and they are free of suffering. And that's what I aspire to. Okay, dedication. So non de tanja de pani. So non de pedanam bonje. Egana jiva untu bei. Se pe sole do adorso. Chamchu sem chogrim poche. Ma ke panam ke gyurji ke manyam parme paryam ke parsham champa poji tar ken padam kuntu sangho deyang vijinte veda kungi jesu dalo Dadam jeratuma tu sunje pigawa tamjeki noa ganga chotunga bagi dajenge we tsawa de kungya sangpo choje ratuma ki jasawa dang chojinga bada Jesu irang gushin soai Dewa chung zedagi chisagpa Tam che zope jang chuchi By this merit may all attain omniscience May defeat the enemy wrongdoing From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.